briefly the Supreme Court, discovering the fact that its primary job is to uphold the rule of law, and it doesn't get any more fundamental than the First Amendment. So that might slow down Trump. The other interesting thing is that more and more and more Americans get their news, regardless of what the original news source is, from the internet. They don't read newspapers anymore, and a lot of listeners to public radio listen on the internet. It's harder to censor the internet. And you could imagine media gravitating to the internet. Even the Chinese Communist Party had trouble creating what was called the Great Firewall of China to keep Chinese citizens from accessing the internet. So I don't think he's going to put the free press out of business, but I think we need to be vigilant.
Well, I'd like to get Maria Ressa to comment on what's happening in the U.S. as well. Of course, you have devoted your life to fighting for free expression in the Philippines, for which you were awarded a Nobel Peace Prize in 2021. So if you could talk first about your site, Rappler, the repeated attempts by the Duterte government to have you imprisoned, several, 10, I believe, arrest warrants issued against you, and how, despite all of that, you kept Rappler running throughout.
Yeah, no, first, thank you for having me. But, you know, let me just be a little bit more dire than Robert. I just came from Perugia, from the International Journalism Festival, where VDEM, which does kind of a rating of all democracies globally, right? Their latest report now says that 72% of the world is under autocratic rule. Like, we have elected illiberal leaders in 72% in these democracies around the world, right?
Well, how do they classify the U.S.?
The U.S. is, so here's what he said. The head of VDEM publicly said that if the trends in America continue, that he expects democracy to die by the summer. Like, not just to wake you up, right? Like, literally. And actually, if we stop normalizing the death by a thousand cuts of rule of law, you can see this happening, right? For the Turkish grad student picked up from the streets, from Tufts University, from all of the little things. We've talked here about the press. The press was attacked in the first level, in the first Trump administration, right? Duterte echoed President Trump. President Trump echoed Duterte. Enemies of the people. That's what they both called us. But the point here is, we normalize new depths. Like, we should not be where we are, and yet that's where we are. And what are you seeing being created? At the early days, in the first month, I called it the Filipinization of American politics, but I think it's even worse, because what you're seeing, not many mainstream media covered the government pausing the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, right? Saying, essentially telling Americans that it's okay to be corrupt because you need to be competitive. These are the ideals that are being broken down. So what are we seeing? We're seeing the creation of a kleptocracy. The last part here is, Robert talked about the internet, but these big tech companies, the broligarchy, who were there in the front row, right?
At his inauguration.
At his inauguration. The design of social media, and this was a clip you ran in the tease at the beginning, it literally turns the incentive structure upside down, is on the side of a populist dictate, a dictator to be, right? Because why? In 2018, MIT said that lies spread 6 times faster. That was before Elon Musk bought Twitter and turned it to X and turned it into a human cesspool, even worse than it was in 2018. So if lies spread 6 times faster, and fear, anger, and hate, this is across the world. If you use fear, anger, and hate, it spreads and I put rabbit ears on information, the post spreads virally. Right? So there are more ways. Online violence is real world violence. The reason why 72% of the world today is now under authoritarian rule is partly because our public information ecosystem is corrupted. Good morning.
I remember you being on the show here years ago when Duterte was really going after you, when he was the leader of the Philippines now, and we'll talk about this in a moment.
Yes.
He's in prison at The Hague. But When you walked out, you said, don't take this as just an example of, you know, this sort of story of the Philippines. You said, this could be happening to you in just a few years. I see us as a warning for you. So talk about, I mean, Nermeen mentioned how many times they attempted to arrest you.
Yeah.
Talk about how you dealt with this and how you fought back, because I think law firms are seeing, universities are seeing, all of these institutions, when they fight back, Trump blinks.
So first, I think the biggest lesson we learned is that you are at your most powerful at the beginning of the attacks. Every day you do not fight back, you lose just a little bit more of your rights. We normalize just a little bit more of this kind of pseudo-democracy, right? We are, so we need to, I think the first is that, what are the steps, right? Social media was used to attack us, and it's like fertilizer. Saying you're the enemy of the press then lets people believe that's astroturfing. For me, hashtag arrest Maria Ressa was trended by pro-government, by pro-Duterte information operations 2 years before I was actually arrested. And that sets the stage. It's like fertilizer. So social media, then media capture, and Robert talked about the chilling effect. Forget the chilling. It's Siberia. And business interests, I talked about the three C's, corrupt, coerce, co-opt. For every single institution that is broken down, media, academe, NGO capture, state capture. And each step of the way as you go down, rule of law breaks down and you lose. It's death by a thousand cuts of your rights. So in the Philippines, you know, it was a rallying cry for us because I'm a traditional journalist in the old sense of the word, right? Like, and I didn't want to be an activist, but when it's a battle for facts, journalism is activism. So in our case, I said, we hold the line. This is the line where the Constitution gives us our rights. The Philippines, like the United States, has three branches, co-equal branches of government, and the United States is following the Philippines. What happened under Duterte, a very powerful executive, a co-opted legislature, and it took Duterte 6 months to crush the checks and balances of the Philippines to get rid of institutional checks on his power. The judiciary, what happens with the judiciary is not only, you talked about the 10 arrest warrants I have, 8 years later, we've won 8 of the 10 cases, but I still have to ask for the Philippines, for approval to travel from the Philippine Supreme Court. What rights you lose today, you will not get back, right? Like, this is part of the reason why, if you value your rights, you stand up for them, you hold the line. Because silence is complicity. Silence gives approval for it. And we create a new normal. Even reporting has to slightly change. You have to call a lie a lie. You have to put the context to it. And anyway, sorry, I can talk about this forever. I feel like I have PTSD and deja vu all combined. You know, it's shocking America is where it is today.
But tell us, so what happened with Rappler? There were constant attempts to shut it down, but somehow you moved the servers abroad or you did something to make sure that despite the crackdown on the media, you were able to continue running.
We prepared, right? You embrace your fear. And you once I figured out what were the worst-case scenarios we could have, we workflowed. I mean, Rappler is small. It's 100, 120 people. And we told our people very early on when the government first tried to shut us down in January 2018, you may not want to be here. This is going to be a different thing. Everyone has a different risk appetite, right? So we gave our reporters the option to leave Rappler because I said, we'll help place you in another news organization. Not one reporter took that, right? And the other part is once you know who you are and what you stand for and you're ready for the worst case, then you stand up for your rights. I think that's the challenge today. And in how to stand up to a dictator, the question I asked Filipinos and I now ask, the reason why I thought it was coming for every democracy around the world is this tech is global. You know, what it proved is that we could all be manipulated in the exact same way, regardless of country or culture. It was like looking at Conrad's Heart of Darkness. Oh, my God. And we're allowing this to happen. They're doing it with impunity for profit. So hold the line. don't give up your rights, because you only get weaker over time.
So you win the Nobel Peace Prize. You travel the world talking about freedom of the press, and Duterte's in jail. Let's talk about this. Former President Rodrigo Duterte was flown to The Hague after being arrested in Manila for crimes against humanity on an international criminal court warrant. The ICC has been investigating Duterte since 2018, as you have, or even further back, over his extrajudicial so-called war on drugs that the UN estimates killed over 8,600 people. Human rights groups in the Philippines say death toll is more like 30,000. Many children were among those killed. Last year, the former president admitted under oath he oversaw a death squad of gangsters while he served as mayor of the southern city of Davao. Can you talk about what this means for the Philippines?
Well, it doesn't end, right? The fight. So what is it? How did he get arrested? It was the work of so many families, so many victims who refused to be victims. And over time, it took that long. And part of it was also Gaza, right? We were told, we've been looking for this since August of 20, my gosh, when was that? 2022. Right, soon after the pandemic. So it took a long time, a lot of work, a focus on justice. And I think the interesting thing here is that what's at stake for the world today is whether or not an international rules-based order still exists. Mm. Whether it's Ukraine or Gaza or tech, right? And then what the Philippines proved is that, and people will say, well, it's power politics. Everything is power politics. What the Philippines proved is that little Philippines actually honored an ICC, the very first time a Filipino president has been charged with crimes against humanity. When he was arrested, I was in the Philippines when that happened. We broke the story in Rappler for the arrest warrant. And when that happened, we didn't know what was going to happen. And I think that's the part, you know, I really want to tell Americans that you take step by step mm-hmm. towards the goal of your values, towards the rights you have, and you don't know what will happen. It's incredibly uncertain. There were times I thought I would go to jail. There were times I had to wear a bulletproof vest in the car, right? So, but you hold tight. And I think that's what, I lost my right to travel. Five times I couldn't travel. Then the Nobel Prize happened and I could travel, but I've still lost some rights. Sorry, the Philippines proved that an international human rights-based order can exist. But we have elections. It's 2 weeks. May 12th, our elections, midterm elections. It's a battle between Marcos and Duterte, the president and his vice president. And
Duterte's daughter.
Duterte's daughter. And Duterte, now in prison at The Hague, has been given a boost. The massive disinformation that has come to the Philippines, Rappler has done three or four stories to track this disinformation, that even though Filipinos know we're being manipulated online, we continue to get manipulated because it's our emotions, right? If Duterte's allies win at the Senate, his daughter is facing impeachment charges, corruption. Again, kleptocracy, it is power and money, right? This is where the world is headed. Hello. And then what happens is if his allies win, Sara Duterte may actually then survive the impeachment, may not lose her post. And that means that's a setup again for another Duterte for our presidential elections. It doesn't end, but the fight for your rights continues. Mm-hmm. Are you going to be silent? And here's the last part. Fear is real. I mean, in the Philippines, there were an average of 8 dead bodies dumped on the sidewalk every night. We had one reporter going out every night, right? So fear is real. And there were times I was angry at Filipinos for not doing more. But we kept going. And I think the Philippines shows you that it could take a while, but justice does happen. But it depends on what happens in America now, mm-hmm. right? Where the world goes. It's still true what happens to America. Will America catches a cold, so does the entire world, right? So look at the markets, as you've said. Anyway, hold on to your rights. I'm worried about 2025 and where the world will take us.
Well, Maria, we also want to ask you about the death of Pope Francis.
Thousands of mourners are lining up again today as Pope Francis's body lies in state in St. Peter's Basilica. His funeral will be on Saturday. You met with the Pope, Pope Francis, several times at the Vatican, including most recently in January at the World Communications Jubilee, where you delivered the opening speech. We're just going to play a clip.
Because we are at the Vatican, I want to point out three things. First, technology rewards lies. Think about that. The first time I met Pope Francis, I said, Pope Francis, it's against the Ten Commandments. Two, the men who control this transformative technology wield godlike power, but they're far from God.
So that was Maria Ressa, the Nobel laureate, speaking at the Vatican with Pope Francis in the audience. It was, what, January 27th. Talk about what Pope Francis means to you. Philippines is a Catholic country. And why he was also so concerned about the media.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, look, I would be what you'd call a wayward Catholic. I mean, you know, I believed in God, but I didn't like the way governance in the five major world religions happen, right? The manipulation, the lack of rights for women, I mean, whatever. But Pope Francis called us about 20 to 30 Nobel Peace Prize winners. And around 2023, we met with him and came out. He thought the world was going crazy, right? War. He stood up against he asked for peace in Ukraine, in Gaza, in all the different.
He called for a ceasefire in Gaza Sunday, Easter, right before he died.
Exactly. And beyond that, this is a pope that understood the role of artificial intelligence. I mean, it was interesting sitting around a table where, you know, you could see all of the world's problems that were existential, from landmines to climate change to nuclear proliferation to, oh my gosh, what would be the next one? I mean, I was at the last in terms of technology and media, right? He understood this. He stood up for the principles that were there. And even for the marginalized, this was a progressive pope. He was inclusive in a way the church had not been. And I think even small things like we quibbled over the word fraternity, right? Because it's sexist in nature, but it's very hard to change an entire Catholic church. So look, I think what he did with us, I was sitting next to Shirin Ebadi from Iran, Tawakkul Karman. It was from Yemen, the first Arab woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize for the Arabs in the Arab Spring, right? And we all came together to demand peace, unity, and press freedom was also something Pope Francis, look, it was a choice. The Jubilee happens once every 25 years for the Catholic Church. And the first speaker he chose, despite the relentless coverage of sexual abuse, both of minors and of women in the Catholic Church, right? Despite all of that, and men, he chose journalists to kick off the Jubilee. Mm. He cared about what was happening around the world. And now, this conservative ally of progressive values, now we're going to see what will happen at the conclave. Who will replace Pope Francis? The church is a powerful force. I guess this is what he taught me, is that faith is incredibly important when you're fighting for your rights.
Two Filipinos are being considered to be the next pope.
Oh, my God. So I knew one. Who's the second?
I don't know which one you know, and I probably don't know the name of the second.
Okay. I know that three Filipinos for the first time, this is huge for the Philippines, are joining the conclave. Mm-hmm. And that was the other thing Pope Francis did, right? He changed the church by changing the people. He moved it away from a Eurocentric kind of global north view, and he brought in Latin America, Sub-Saharan Africa, and Asia, right? So the one that, you know, that has been tipped, and of course, I've been to the Vatican now
like four times in less than 2 years, because when Pope Francis calls, you go, right? And what the whisper, of course, is, and he may be as high as number two, is that Cardinal Tagle. He moved to Rome because the Pope Francis gave him a special, like he changed the rules. He gave him a special appointment to come to Rome. Mm-hmm. And Cardinal Tagle, I believe, is just behind.
We're showing his picture with you.
We were doing this is at the Vatican. And this man is very liberal, progressive. He speaks normally. Again, very, I know him quite well because when I first took over as head of the largest network in the Philippines, Cardinal Tagle had a program on ABS-CBN. Sorry, back to ABS-CBN. The largest broadcaster in the Philippines lost its franchise to operate under Duterte. Franchise is like a license to operate. It never regained it, even after Duterte was gone. I'm just saying, you can cut the deals, corporate media, but once you empower a dictator, you lose these rights.
Mm-hmm. We want to thank you so much for being with us. Certainly an important warning you once again share with us here in the United States. Maria Ressa, co-founder and CEO of the Philippine independent news site Rappler, received the Nobel Peace Prize in 2021 for her work defending free expression in the Philippines as the president at the time, Duterte, went after, attempted to arrest her over and over and over again. We also want to thank Robert Kuttner, the American Prospect. Coming up, Trump administration's war on children. Back in 30 seconds. Lament by Moondog. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We end today's show looking at what ProPublica calls the Trump administration's war on children. Their new report looks at how the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, is putting children at risk by cutting funds for investigating child abuse, enforcing child support payments, providing child care, and more.
We're joined now by ProPublica reporter Eli Hager. So, Eli, lay out your findings.
Well, it's probably been a little bit hard for people to follow all of these cuts across all of these different federal agencies. But one through line that we've tracked at ProPublica is cuts to programs serving children. So across a lot of little known federal agencies with names like the Children's Bureau and the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, there have been cuts to both funding and services and staffing for child protective services, for enforcing child support orders, for child care and all sorts of programs. And the through line has been that those programs serve children.
And Eli, could you say, we'll get into each of the programs that you list in the piece, but why do you think this hasn't been given so much publicity? People aren't aware of how much poor children are being made to suffer by these cuts, or will be.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's definitely true. I think one is just the chaos and the onslaught of cuts at so many different agencies. I think a number of these agencies are relatively anonymous agencies that people haven't heard of. And they're also housed within very large departments like the Health and Human Services and Department of Justice. And these are smaller children's offices within those large departments. And I also just don't think people realize how much the federal government does for children's services and for administering things like CPS and adoption across the country and things like that.
Let's start with Head Start. I mean, this is astounding. Goes to 1 million low-income parents. What this means, eliminating the Lyndon Johnson program from the war on poverty.
Right. There's Head Start in every community across the country. This would especially affect rural areas where often the Head Start program is the only child care facility or location in a whole town. And so 1 million working parents across the country wouldn't have anywhere to send their children during the day if Head Start were to be ended, which the president's budget calls for. Also, these Head Start program directors have been having trouble accessing their congressionally appropriated funds. They're being directed to a DOGE Defend the Spend website, which seems to be new.
This, as Elon Musk calls for people to have more children, and they're talking about actually spending money, giving $5,000 apiece to women who give birth to children.
Right. Yes, that is an irony that we noticed.
And you also talk about in the piece the other areas that have been impacted, including cuts to institutions that investigate child sexual abuse and internet crimes against children, responding to reports of missing children, and preventing youth violence. If you could elaborate on some of those, like where, under what organization or department do those fall?
Right. So what we noticed was that it wasn't just cuts to kind of these more liberal-coded programs like support for child care and direct assistance to lower-income families with children, but also these programs that have much more support across the political spectrum, like funds and staffing for investigating child abuse and child protective services. A lot of that is funded by the Social Services Block Grant, and the entire staff that delivers that block grant was laid off by Robert F. Kennedy at HHS. And then you also at the Department of Justice have cuts to or delayed or blocked funding for local law enforcement to investigate internet crimes against children, for programs that respond to cases of missing children, for Amber Alerts, for all of these things that respond to very serious cases of violence against children.
And talk about the cutting off of health care for what, some 800,000 children? And then, of course, with the threats to Medicaid, the millions of children covered by Medicaid.
Yeah, I think one thing that people don't realize is that children are actually they receive Medicaid in greater numbers than any other age group. Nearly 40% of the people who rely on Medicaid our children, whether that's in school-based healthcare or in foster care or residential facilities, whether it's for their disabilities or for cancer treatment. The potential cuts to Medicaid would be devastating to children across the country.
And is there any recourse that these agencies have? I mean, are these cuts inevitable and going into effect?
So it depends on which one. The cuts to Head Start to staffing and potentially to its funding seem imminent, and Head Start programs are already closing in several parts of the country. That's probably one of the more imminent ones. The cuts at DOJ for local law enforcement seem like they may happen, but there's a chance that some of that funding gets reinstated. The department said that they're still considering some of the grants. So there's a spectrum. Obviously, we know that with Medicaid, that's still up in the air, but it looks like the Republicans in Congress are going to be cutting Medicaid.
And you got a response from Robert Kennedy's office, of course, in charge of Health in America, saying they're going to put money into establishing MAHA, right, the Administration for Healthy America.
Right. They're going to consolidate all these children's programs at the Administration for Children and Families that had run child care and Head Start and the child support system. It's another big one that the federal government does. It makes sure that child support payments get to families. All of those are going to be reduced and consolidated into this other area.
Well, Eli Hager, we're going to have to leave it to folks reading your piece. Eli Hager is a ProPublica reporter. We'll link to his new piece, The Trump Administration's War on children. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
Greetings, netizens. Join us every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific for Bitcoover FM, featuring the best in chiptune, video game soundtracks, synthesized music, history of electronic instruments, and more, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM. We'll see you in the virtual plaza, and remember to synthesize with nostalgia.